Back to the Dave Nemo Show.
Dr. Bruce Leyendyk is a distinguished professor emeritus from UC Santa Barbara. He was elected a fellow of the Geological Society of America, the American Geophysical Union, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In addition, in 2016, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names honored the author by naming Summit 1070 in Antarctica Mountain. Well, they named it, dig this, Mount Leyendyk. He joins us this morning. We are so thrilled to have him. We've been actually reading adventure books, The Wager, books about pirates on the African coast, and we now add another great adventure. Mighty Badland, a perilous expedition to Antarctica, reveals clues to an eighth continent. Its author, Bruce Leyendyk. Dr. Bruce Leyendyk joins us this morning. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And like I said, the book, while actually being impeccably researched, going from your own notes, going from your own experiences and all that kind of stuff, is written in many ways to actually put you in the middle, to put the reader alongside of you in this really dangerous and thrilling adventure. Can we kind of start off talking about the title, about the idea of the eighth continent, and about the geography of the world you were going into? And we'll talk about the geography, then talk about your own preparation, and then the adventure itself. Talk about this world that you were looking at in this book.
Sure. Yeah, so Antarctica is at the bottom of the world. The way to find it on the map is if you go into the Pacific Ocean, find Hawaii, then immediately due south of Antarctica, of Hawaii, down at the bottom of the world is part of Antarctica we worked on, which is called Maria Birdland. Now, Antarctica today sits by itself at the South Pole, and it's isolated by an ocean current that's circles it, and the southern continents would be Australia and South America, and those continents were once joined up with Antarctica as a supercontinent named Gondwana, and this started to break up around 100 million years or so ago. So all these present day continents were broken off from a supercontinent, which is situated pretty close to the pole back 100 million years ago, and those pieces have since drifted north, including pieces that now host the island nation of New Zealand. So that's the short story of the geography. I can say a few words about Zealandia if you'd like me to.
I would, because that actually sets this up really nicely. So we go from Gondwana to Zealandia. So talk about Zealandia here real quick, and then we'll go to your own background and how you end up in this far corner of the world.
Sure. Well, Zealandia is pieces of a sunken continent. Zealandia is largely below sea level, not a lot, maybe a few hundred feet. But the part of it that sticks above sea level, current sea level, is the island nation of New Zealand. But the part of it that's below sea level is much, much larger than that island nation. If you put all the pieces together, it's about the size of India. Now, it was these submerged plateaus, we call them, were recognized by mapping sort of in the later part of the 20th century, and believe it or not, the mapping that started this off was from satellites traversing the Pacific Ocean. So they gave a good outline of these continental fragments now covered by ocean, except for New Zealand, that were scattered around this southwest corner of the Pacific. And the Zealandia notion is that all these fragments, these continental pieces, were also part of Gondwana. They were glued together and then glued to Antarctica as part of Gondwana. Now, they weren't pieces until Gondwana started to break up into pieces and then drift away from each other, Antarctica staying pretty much at the pole while the other pieces moved north into the South Pacific, what is now the South Pacific. Why is it a continent? Why is Elandia a continent? Well, first of all, part of it sticks up is all continental rocks, and the parts that are submerged have been drilled and sampled by geologists, and those are also continental rocks. And it sticks above the ocean floor. The ocean floor is really deep there, so they're very obvious once they were mapped in detail. So that's the short story.
All right. So we now then turn our attention to around your 50th year of existence, the late 80s, early 90s. You engage in an adventure that many people at that age back then would not have done. Can you talk about the impetus to actually take the trip down into that treacherous area of the world and your own background and why it is you were actually leading a team of equals, as you say in the book?
Sure. At the time, a few years before we mounted the expedition, I was working in New Zealand with my colleague Dave on a particular type of rocks, and it was proving pretty difficult because of the vegetation that covered everything, and the deconstruction of the rocks by weathering, crumbling of everything, and it was extremely difficult. And these are very interesting rocks and distinctive. So we knew there was some work in this area of Marie Birdland that suggested there were rocks that were a matchup to these rocks, mountain ranges in New Zealand. So these matchup mountain ranges, but very little was known about the one in Antarctica. So we decided, the way to learn about this is instead of bushwhacking in New Zealand in the rain, we could go to Antarctica where the rocks are well exposed. They haven't been weathered by rain and heat, and they're in good shape. And we can test the idea that the New Zealand was once adjoined to Antarctica by matching up the rocks, like a torn newspaper in half, and you can read the print on one side and then it continues on the other side. So it was basically that idea. So we just said we were working in the Southern Alps of New Zealand, and then we said, well, let's go to Antarctica. And that's what we did over one dinner we had. And 2 years later, we were there.
It's interesting, too, because you make this point, the idea that despite the fact that the conditions in Antarctica are so much more treacherous, so much more dangerous for human existence in regards to getting a clean sample, I guess maybe another way of putting it, in order to get it's almost like you had one piece of the puzzle, but it was frayed and torn and a little bit worn. You had to go to a more dangerous place to find a better preserved piece of the puzzle to be able to then see if it matched up correctly. So you then have to kind of let people know this, the idea of there are people who, have gone down there in their late 20s, people who have gone down there in their mid 20s, early 30s, and it's damn near killed them as well, too. When you open the book up, and I want to give people a sense of how dangerous it is down there, can you kind of take our listeners through some of the stuff you had to do to get ready in order to be able to make the trip at the age you were at that point?
Sure. Well, I was pushing 50, and part of me knew that I had to get in shape. So I enrolled in the Y and started working on that. And then the National Science Foundation, who's the outfit that controls everything that pays for and controls everything that happens down at Antarctica, they want to make sure that you're physically qualified to go. And so they send you a package of instructions to go to doctors and dentists to get signed off. Because there's really, in Antarctica, there's some infrastructure, but there's no ER. It's kind of like an urgent care in McMurdo. And if you're going out into Marie Birdland, into Mighty Badland, there absolutely is nothing. You take your med supplies with you and you take care of yourself. So when I filled out this form, there was a couple of questions in there that I had to check off, honestly. So, have you ever had asthma? So, yeah, I have asthma. I checked that off. few weeks later, get response back from National Science Foundation, not qualified. I was disqualified for it. So I appealed it, and I don't quit. I'm not a quitter. So, I asked, what can I do about this? And they said, okay, well, you could take what's called the cold air challenge, which is what they do is they put you on a bicycle in a medical lab with your nose clipped and you're breathing through a tube that's got cold air coming out at freezing temperature, and then you bicycle for X minutes to get up to your maximum heart rate, and you got sensors glued all over your chest to see how you're doing with your breathing and your heart. And then you do that for 5-10 minutes. Then you get off and you sit, and they ask you to exhale every few minutes, and they measure your exhale and your exhale rate. So a short story is, they want to see if you can function, if you have exercise-induced asthma in cold air conditions. That's the question. Do you have that or not? So it turned out that I did not. So when I had my doctor write a letter to the NSF, and they cleared me. So that was her first hurdle. I hadn't even gone there. Was to pass this medical exam, this extensive medical exam.
I wanted to kind of point this out too for our listeners, by the way. If you guys get a chance to check out Mighty Bad Land, a perilous expedition to Antarctica reveals clues to an eighth continent. I wanted to point this out as well too, Dr. Leyendijk. There's almost an element of science fiction to this. Of course, you know, John W. Campbell's famous short story, Who Goes There, which is the basis of The Thing, H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, but also the real-life stories of Robert Falcon Scott, Ernest Shackleford. All of these stories kind of play through. It really is a science fiction world in the sense that it is as close, what is it, deep-sea diving, true deep-sea diving, and this world are as close as we get to leaving the planet without leaving the planet. It is that kind of unrelenting. It's almost like you're training to be an astronaut to a large degree in regards to what you kind of have to deal with, because you have to be able to physically deal with that while doing actually exacting scientific work. So it's a matter of not just being physically able, but mentally able too. They really have to kind of figure out if you're in mental condition to take this journey as well, correct?
Yeah, that's correct also. Yeah, they want to know your psychological background, that's also checked. I had some cases of anxiety and insomnia, and I answered yes to that, and I had to get checked out by doctors that, you know, I could function. I'd be functional, and I had a record to prove that I was functional, and that I could pass that challenge also.
I want to point out to our listeners, by the way, that so much of this book is written poetically. So much of it is written, it's not a work of fiction, and it is true, but it is written in a way that actually is meant to draw the reader in. It is not a series of charts and graphs. All that kind of stuff is placed very nice and neatly in other sections of the book, but the principal story and the adventure that kind of takes place is really at the heart of it. I wanted to ask you in regards to revisiting this, because we're going to run out of time here. I told you this would go by fast. In the writing of the book, Dr. Leyendijk, did you find that there were things that you hadn't remembered that you remember that you discovered that either kind of left you in awe of what you actually had gone through, or things that where you remembered and you like are glad you'll never have to do that again?
Yes. This exercise, as you point out, I was amazed at the things I remembered, like even the conversations. I mean, this is the kind of experience that really imprints. It's a footprint in your brain from doing something like this. And kind of these, oh, yeah, moments like flashbacks. So I remember that now. Now that I have to think about it, I do remember it. And the one thing that I read about when I wrote this, that's kind of says, what was I thinking? Was these blizzards that trapped you in the tents. We lived in tents, two to a tent. And these would go on for days. not this expedition, but the one that follows it, we were trapped in a tent for 10 days. I mean, that's kind of astonishing to think that you can actually, like, not go crazy while your tent's snapping like a rifle and the wind is howling and you're kind of just doing the same stuff for 10 days, or in our cases, 3 or 4 days at a time. Yeah, that's tough stuff. That was hard for me, it was, at least.
It's funny because as I was reading the book, there were so many things, you know, and you would really make a point of kind of going through the detail of the kind of gear you had to wear and often talking about how silly stuff looked, and then somebody kind of calmly turning to you and saying, well, you cannot wear that and literally lose your toes. You cannot wear that and literally be dead within, like, you know, 20 minutes. And early on in the book, guys, I'm trying not to give as little away as possible. Early on in the book, when the discussion comes about in the plains, getting to the point of no return, and in the plains, not having any sort of landing gear. Remember, we're also in 1990. There's no GPS system. There's no internet. Not that those things are readily available down there right now either. But in many ways, you are flying blind and using only the elements and all that. Dr. Bruce, we're out of time. I knew this would happen. I do want to save a little bit of space. Is there a website people can visit? There's also an audiobook available of this, is there not?
Yes, you can get the Mighty Badland on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And on Amazon, there's a hardcover, a Kindle, and an audiobook. And I've listened to the audiobook. It's really, really well done.
Fantastic. Guys, please check out the book, Mighty Badlands, A Perilous Expedition to Antarctica Reveals Clues to an Eighth Continent. Dr. Bruce Leyendijk has joined us this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Best of luck with the book, by the way, and I really enjoyed reading it. I think a lot of our listeners will, too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you. Bye-bye.